Simone Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. These days, wearing a face mask is A, necessary, B, harmful, C, political, or D, all of the above. We'll hear the psychology behind why right now, for better or worse, the answer seems to be all of the above. Plus, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has yet to choose his running mate. We'll hear from the California congresswoman who may get that call. It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez, coming up.
There is raising the standards of policing, and then there are community-based grants so people can begin to re-envision what policing is in the United States.
That's Congresswoman Karen Bass talking to us about police reform and also about being on the short list for Joe Biden's vice president. That's coming up. But first, officials are rethinking how we open L.A. as the number of COVID-19 cases spikes. Just yesterday, L.A. County reported an additional 2,903 cases, prompting officials to shut down beaches over the 4th of July weekend. Already, bars were closed down again by order of the governor, though the source of the spread could be from many things. Backyard barbecues, for one. One thing seems to be clear, though. People are not following safety guidelines, not keeping 6 feet apart, and not wearing masks in public. Here's Governor Newsom on that earlier today.
If you're not going to stay home and you're not going to wear masks in public, we have to enforce, and we will.
The mask factor is why Hugo's Tacos shut its door on Sunday. It's a very simple request to ask customers to wear a face covering while inside, but at Hugo's, it was causing enough of a conflict between staff and customers that the owners decided to temporarily close both of their locations. Bill Cohn is one of those owners, and he joined us earlier to discuss what was happening.
The mask issue isn't the only thing that people in the service industry have to confront every day, but it has become one of the more colorful and vitriolic elements lately. Some of the reactions that our staff has reported receiving, it's been being called names, mocking or simply repeating everything that the crew member is saying to the customer, or the customer will just ignore them altogether. But the prevailing mood that they're experiencing is this taunting, this defiance, this you can't tell me what to do. Some people resorting to just screaming, demanding refunds, all kinds of just very colorful, vigorous behavior that they do find that can be physically intimidating. Certainly, it takes an emotional toll. People in the service industry are used to hangry customers. People don't always behave themselves, but when you spend a good part of your day with this kind of reaction, when all you're trying to do is give somebody a delicious taco, it's something that you replay when you go home, and it takes a toll.
Bill, what will this mean, Bill, for your business financially?
It's going to be a hit. It'll be a short-term hit, but I think the short-term hit is small in comparison to hopefully the long-term gain. If we can find a way to snap somehow this fever that the community around us is in, and just get people to see that wearing a mask for us is a 5 or 10 minute inconvenience in terms of this transaction. It's worth the price that we're asked to pay if we can move this conversation forward a little bit.
You mentioned short-term hit. Does that mean that you're going to be closed only in the short term?
We don't expect this closure to last for very long. Really, it was contemplated as a moment to catch our breath.
Yeah.
An opportunity quietly to look at what our options are, double down on the internal security protocols. But we also need to look at the exteriors of our building because, again, we only have two little windows in small buildings. But what's happening in the perimeter between those windows and in our parking lots somehow leads to these confrontations. So we're going to have to find a way to take apparently more steps outside our buildings to protect the people inside. There will likely be somebody out front who's going to be checking your compliance before you even approach a window.
Bill, when the time comes where Hugo's Tacos will be open again, what do you want people just to have in mind?
I want them to have their neighbors' health and security in mind. That's all that we're asked to do with a mask. We're simply asked to wear it as a gesture that will help protect the people around us.
Bill Cohn, part owner of Hugo's Tacos in L.A. Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you.
All right, as we just heard, disputes over masks can be stressful, to say the least. And even though research shows that face coverings can slow the spread of the coronavirus, some people still are not willing to wear one. USC Assistant Research Professor of Psychology, Dr. Jonas Kaplan, has been studying why that is. Doctor, welcome to Take Two. Hello, Doctor, are you there? All right, we're going to try and reconnect with Dr. Jonas Kaplan of USC coming up in just a minute. All right, we're back. Actually, Dr. Jonas Kaplan is now with us. Doctor, are you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, good, good, perfect. All right, now we're going to get into the psychology of why people will not wear face masks. And you wanted to figure out why people just don't want to wear them in the first place. And you recently did some polling. So what did you hear from people?
Yeah, that's right. Well, first of all, it's complicated and everyone has different reasons for not wearing a mask. Some people complain that it isn't comfortable or that it fogs up their glasses. As a glasses wearer myself, I'm sympathetic to that. But the big thing that we see is that this is really politicized. There are big differences between liberals and conservatives on how much they believe masks are effective against the disease and how willing they are to wear them. One of the things that the conservatives in particular tell us is that they don't want to be forced to wear a mask when they don't want to wear one. They view this mandate to wear a mask as a violation of their individual liberty. And the idea that they have to wear a mask is sort of a symbol of an overreaching government to them. So that's a uniquely conservative reason for not wanting to wear a mask. Conservatives were also more likely to tell us that wearing a mask makes you look silly or makes you look weak. So there are different reasons people have for wearing masks. And unfortunately, this seems to be very politicized, that it's tied to our political identities. And that makes it really difficult for communicators. It's difficult not to crack because we know that beliefs that are tied to our identities, our ideas of who we are really hard to change.
Yeah, because when it comes to the liberals or the Democrats in this case, the ideological reasons, what drives that association?
We don't really see too many ideological reasons in liberals. Liberals told us that they were very, very willing to wear masks and that they often did wear masks. So the ideology-driven reasons we saw mostly on the conservative side. And that's interesting, and it suggests that maybe we should be targeting our messages towards conservative values if we want to get people to increase their mask wearing.
Because Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now recommends face coverings, but that isn't convincing everyone. Doctor, why not? Why isn't this organization not convincing people that?
Well, one of the things we find is that people who don't wear masks have very low trust in science. So there's a general distrust of scientific authority. The other thing it didn't help is the inconsistent messaging from public health authorities. You know, one of the things we know from the psychology of this is it's really hard to change a belief once it's rooted in your mind. Beliefs grow like trees within your mind. They start to extend their roots as soon as you accept the belief. So if we give people information and it turns out not to be true and we try to change it later, it's very hard to dislodge those beliefs that are already in people's heads. So that's part of the problem.
Doctor, why wouldn't common sense work in this case? I mean, there's something in the air and these pieces of cloth could separate you from that thing in the air. Is that just breaking it down too much?
I mean, maybe, but, you know, problem is that we have brains that are designed to protect ourselves, and we're very motivated to protect everything about ourselves, not just our physical bodies, but also our psychology, our ideas about what we think is true. Once we incorporate a belief into our identity, our idea of who we are, the brain wants to protect it just like it wants to protect our bodies, and so we get very defensive when we encounter information that challenges those beliefs. There's some studies showing that when you give people information that's counter to something they believe, you can often even create a backfire effect where people's beliefs get stronger as a result of that because you kind of drum up our defenses. So just giving people information doesn't seem to do the trick. We have to do something else. And we think that maybe what that something else is to try to connect with people's values, what's important to people and what they really care about.
But it's almost as if, Doctor, it's almost as if you're talking about children in a way, right? How you get kids to eat vegetables when they don't want to. You figure out ways around the fact that they should be eating their vegetables because it's good for them.
I think I agree with you strategically, although I wouldn't want to imply that we're dealing with children. These are adults. And,
you know, should listen to my uncle when I try to get him to wear a mask, but that's another topic.
I hear you.
Now, the threat, of disease, that also doesn't seem to be persuading people, because just today, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who we all know from the president's coronavirus task force, said that we could see 100,000 cases a day if people do not follow the rules and keep a safe distance and wear a mask.
We're going to continue to be in a lot of trouble, and there's going to be a lot of hurt if that does not stop.
So why do these dire predictions from officials not at least move the needle with some people?
They may move the needle with some people. They don't seem to move the needle across the population very much, partly because people just don't believe it. I mean, there's a lot of distrust. Again, we see a lot of conspiratorial thinking in people who don't agree with wearing masks. And information about the threat of the disease doesn't seem to get through. One of the things we found is that conservative people tend to rate the threat of the disease as very low compared to liberals. So the idea that this disease is a threat just doesn't seem to be getting in from the first place.
So, doctor, just to tell you about my uncle really quick, the way I got him to wear a mask, I'm not kidding you. My wife made him two Marine Corps masks. He was in the Marines a long time ago. Now he wears a mask all the time. But that's kind of what I'm talking about. I had to really kind of jazz it up to get him to want to wear a mask.
Well, that's a great idea of the kind of reframing that we can do. So with people who, you know, for whom being connected to America or to the Marine Corps is important, connecting the idea of wearing a mask with those symbols, it might be something that works either by printing it on the mask or by reminding people that this is a way that we can actually work together to save America.
All right. Now, from a neurological perspective, what's going on with this? Because why does this mask controversy provoke such a primal response? We've seen video after video of people in stores having public outbursts where they're just going crazy and they storm away off, you know, just angry as can be. So why what's going on neurologically there?
It's incredible. I don't know. I mean, we think that social group identity is very important to humans, to people. It's very important for us to feel part of a group. And then when that identity is threatened, we react just like our physical bodies are being threatened. And we see that when we look in the brain. We've done some brain imaging studies on what happens when people's political beliefs are threatened. And we find that the areas of the brain that are responsible for responding to physical threats and supporting the emotions and feelings we have when we're threatened are also active when our beliefs and ideas about politics are threatened. And actually, those people that activate those emotional brain regions more are people who seem to be less susceptible to taking in new information. So this is something that's deep within us, this self-protective tribal brain that we have.
Wondering if this is a uniquely American problem.
I don't think the general psychological principles that underlie the phenomenon are American. I think they're universal. You know, everyone in the world is subject to motivated reasoning and bias. We all find it difficult to change our minds about things that are important to us, yeah. Whether those are beliefs about masks or beliefs about, you know, whether cheddar cheese should go on a taco. If it's important to you, it matters. But the things that are important to us in America may be uniquely American. The idea that, you know, being connected with your political party is so important for your identity is probably something that's special here in America. And the particular values that this is tied to of freedom from oppression and liberty might also be specifically American.
So how to talk to people then about wearing masks? Because when I see someone without a mask in a public space, doctor, my blood starts to boil and I want to avoid talking to them or being in front of them for, you know, any which way I can. So how do we get someone to understand that this is best for the common good?
We're working on that. I don't think we have the answer yet. We know a lot more about what doesn't work than what does work. And what doesn't work is making people defensive, coming at them and challenging them directly and giving them information that we think just contradicts everything they believe. We really think that connecting with people's values is the way to go, to find the common value that we share with them and then communicate based on that. So if you're dealing with someone who cares about the community and their family, and we can assume that's a common value that we all share, to talk about how masks protect us and protect the community by preventing the spread of the disease might be one way in.
All right, that's USC Assistant Research Professor of Psychology, Dr. Jonas Kaplan. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has yet to choose his running mate. We'll hear from the California congresswoman who may get that call. She was born in Los Angeles, raised in Venice and Fairfax, went to Hamilton High, also went to USC Keck School of Medicine and Cal State Dominguez Hills. Get to know Karen Bass. Karen Bass is coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Ian Martinez. Robert Fuller is being laid to rest today. Services began at 1 this afternoon and have been streaming live on YouTube from the Living Stone Cathedral of Worship in the Antelope Valley.
We have come to celebrate the life of a young man, to share with this family, and we are honored that you would allow us to be a part of the celebration of his life. We as a people have learned how to rejoice in the midst of pain. We've learned how to celebrate in the midst of injustice.
Meanwhile, the LA Sheriff's Department is still investigating his death. The 24-year-old black man was found hanging from a tree in Palmdale earlier this month. And there's a lot of suspicion in the area about what exactly happened to him. KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale says that's partly because of the long history of racism in the Antelope Valley.
A large American flag ripples in the desert breeze at the park where Robert Fuller's body was found. That's not lost on community members who step up to the mic at a rally on a recent afternoon.
Do you see the symbolism of why they put it under the flag?
People here are skeptical that Fuller's death was a suicide. The initial explanation that the LA County Sheriff's Department issued and then retracted days later. Some locals call it a lynching, and they're demanding an independent investigation into Fuller's death by the California Attorney General. Zana Nora is black. He grew up in Palmdale, and he's around the same age as Fuller.
The things that I've gone through, that could have been me.
Things like being told by white classmates that the KKK was going to get him. Or at 12 years old, being chased out of a restaurant by men with swastika tattoos.
We kind of ran into like the desert area that we were close to and ran and hid in a bush.
The Antelope Valley was predominantly white until the late 1970s, when black and brown people started relocating to the area in search of more affordable and safer places to live. Neo-Nazis and skinhead groups have lurked in the area for decades, linked to hate crimes including stabbings and the firebombing of a black church. A U.S. Department of Justice report found that by 2010, the Antelope Valley had the highest rate of hate crimes of any region in L.A. County. And last year, a photo of local elementary school teachers smiling and holding a noose went viral and caused some parents to pull their kids out of class.
It's a powder keg. A bomb ready to explode.
That's Farrell Mitchell, the co-founder of the Antelope Valley activist group Community Action League. Over a decade ago, the Antelope Valley had another big problem. Black renters receiving federal Section 8 housing assistance were calling Mitchell, telling him they were being harassed by the Sheriff's Department. The number of local black Section 8 renters doubled in the early 2000s and continued to grow into the 2010s. Tony Clark was one of them. In 2008, she and a friend were driving from a barbecue when they saw flashing lights from a deputy's car.
They pulled us over. They treated my friend like crap.
The deputy cited Clark for $5 worth of medical marijuana in her purse. Because of that, she lost her eligibility for Section 8 subsidies and became homeless. The U.S. Department of Justice launched an investigation in 2011. Farrell Mitchell said renters told investigators about intrusive and harmful compliance checks that led to many of them losing their housing vouchers.
Our first meeting with the Department of Justice, over 300 people showed up to that meeting.
In 2015, the Justice Department accused LA County Housing Authority investigators and the Sheriff's Department of working together to discriminate against black Section 8 residents in the hopes of driving them out of the valley. The Housing Authority denied any wrongdoing, but eventually agreed to pay a $2 million settlement. The Sheriff's Department also insisted its deputies did nothing wrong, but it paid an additional $700,000 and agreed to reforms. Tony Clark received some money from the settlements, but she never got her subsidized housing back. At a press conference about Robert Fuller's death, I asked Sheriff Alex Villanueva about how the region's history of racial discrimination, which included his department, affected community trust.
That happened before I took office as sheriff. I think the reforms have been put in place. They're working to date.
Villanueva said his officers are part of the community and many do live in the community. There was one sign of change earlier this month. A high school in the Antelope Valley agreed to drop its mascot, Johnny Rebel, a cartoon Confederate soldier. But many Black residents say the area's problems won't be solved that easily. Here's how Tony Clark, who grew up in Pasadena before moving to the Antelope Valley, puts it.
They didn't want Pasadena out here. They don't want Los Angeles out here. They don't want no Blacks out here.
A few days after Robert Fuller's death, Clark was talking to a relative about the protests.
And she goes, "That's our cousin."
Turns out Fuller was a distant cousin of Clark's. And Clark told me she wasn't even that surprised about the connection, because this cycle of tragedy is what she and her loved ones have dealt with for decades. Covering criminal justice, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
All right, turning now to police reform efforts in Congress. Last week, House Democrats passed a wide-ranging reform bill that, among other things, would ban chokeholds, outlaw no-knock warrants in drug cases, and reform qualified immunity, making it easier to pursue claims against police officers in civil court. Now, for a host of reasons, the Republican Senate is not likely to pick up the bill before November, but its passage casts a new spotlight on fifth-term Congresswoman Karen Bass of Los Angeles. Bass chairs the Congressional Black Caucus, and though she's no household name in national politics, her past and present efforts on police reform have landed her on the short list of potential vice presidential picks for Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee. So, what does she think of the current unrest in our nation? Take Two's Austin Cross sat down with Congresswoman Bass earlier today.
Congresswoman Bass, thank you so much for making the time today.
Sure, you're welcome.
I want to ask you about your bill that passed the House last week, but first I want to actually ask you about something that I read while researching for our chat today. Before becoming the first Black woman to be elected Speaker of the state legislature here, and long before you became a Congresswoman, you were an activist protesting police brutality here in LA back in 1973.
That's right.
Which I thought was fascinating because here we are decades later.
47 years.
Still having some of the same conversations about policing. How does that make you feel?
Right. Well, it really makes me feel humbled and honored that I'm in a position to take up legislation like this. And it's been an awful long time coming, but I think one of the major reasons why it happened now is because of technology. Technology could expose what we were crying and fighting and pushing about 47 years ago.
You know, that was more than a decade before I was born. But my dad was a Black man living in Los Angeles at that time, and he was well aware of the LAPD's reputation, especially for the chokeholds. So his answer was to start wearing a suit and tie every day, hoping that dressing well would keep him safe.
And I'm sure it didn't.
You know what? He used to get pulled over going down Wilshire Boulevard. He used to get pulled over weekly until he made that decision. But I'm kind of wondering, when you look at the history of policing in LA, have we come very far from back then, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think things are better, but that doesn't mean they're good. You know, the police chief that we had then, we literally had to change the city charter in order to be able to fire him. He was police chief from 1973 to 1993 in my memory, and he didn't just get hired in 1973. So he had already been on the force for a long time. So we still have a lot to do in LA, but at least some of the structural problems we had back then, we don't have now. So that makes the situation better.
And I've heard before, you've got some very vivid memories of the Rodney King riots too, when those started happening. I mean, do you think that there were changes that came out of that that we can maybe feel the benefits of today, even?
One of the reasons why the riots happened was because Chief Gase was in the West LA area at a fundraiser raising money to defeat the ballot initiative that would help us get him fired. So yes, that change absolutely came. And we were able to get police chiefs that weren't necessarily from the ranks, because I think that was a problem as well. Because Daryl Gates and Ed Parker trained one or two generations, if not more, of police officers. And so that culture, there's still police officers on the force who were there when Gates was there, Many of them say they have changed, they've transformed. But, you know, again, we still have issues with policing in LA.
And I'm really glad that you brought up culture, because I really want to actually ask you something about that later. But I actually want to ask you about your bill, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. It takes several different swings at the policing reform idea. What are some of the reforms that are included in that bill?
Well, I would say in three different areas. There's police accountability, there is raising the standards of policing, and then there are community-based grants so people can begin to re-envision what policing is in the United States.
So you mentioned the culture, and I want to come back to that, because there was a New York female police officer a few years back who was allegedly fired. Yeah, you know, you mentioned this a few times in the past, and she was allegedly fired when she intervened when her colleague had a suspect in a chokehold. That's one of the things that you would now make mandatory in your bill if it were to be passed. You would have to report your colleague. And I'm just wondering, from a cultural level of the police departments, what will come first? Will the change in the police departments come and then the bill will kind of come in and help with that? Or will the bill be the thing that helps change that culture by making it mandatory? That culture has to change.
You know, I mean, a bill can never change culture. A bill can set a foundation and provide police departments with the tools to change the culture. But culture change takes leadership. So we can pass all the legislation in the world. If you don't have the right leadership, then who is going to enforce and ensure that the legislation is followed? And that means leadership from a chief, but that also needs leadership from a governing body, depending on where the police department is located. That might be a mayor, that might be a board of supervisors. It just depends. But leadership is key to culture change.
I mean, right now, it's very hard for me to imagine a shift happening that's so large that a colleague would essentially rat out their other colleagues, especially considering what we know about police culture, right?
Well, that's the point of raising the standards, because if you raise the standards in policing, you don't want to have to deal with the viewpoint of ratting folks out. You want to have people who say, I don't want to serve with corrupt police officers, as opposed to what exists now. I mean, the woman that interrupted the chief, the chokehold, she was fired. We don't want that culture.
We're talking to Congresswoman Karen Bass about her police reform bill. Now, I understand that as you were pushing this bill through Congress, you personally met with the Fraternal Order of Police, and that's one of the world's largest police associations. And they also represent what many activists today think of as the so-called problem with policing. For example, one chapter president referred to Black Lives Matter as a rabid pack of animals. And I'm wondering,
oh my God, who was that?
This was one in Philadelphia from what I read.
Jeez.
What came out of your conversations with them, though, I'm wondering, and why was it important to try to get them on board, do you?
Well, I mean, you want as many people, when you're doing legislation, you want as many people on board as possible. I talked to the Fraternal Order of Police. I talked to the Chief Police Association, the police union in Los Angeles. I talked to lots and lots of people. And, you know, there were parts of the bill they opposed and there were parts of the bill that they supported. In particular, the Fraternal Order of Police, like having national standards, like having accreditation. So, you know, you just continue on.
Have you heard back from them since you put the bill out there and the House voted on it?
Yes. But so the discussions will continue.
Discussions will continue. Okay. The Senate has also pushed for a police reform bill of its own, and that one was authored by Republican Tim Scott. He's a Black senator from South Carolina. There is some overlap with your bills, yet without Democratic support in the Senate, of course, his bill is stalled. Why should the Senate pick up your bill instead of his?
Because our bill is better. His bill mimics ours, but it doesn't have any enforcement or any teeth into it.
In what way?
Well, he has chokeholds. He has no knock. He does not have qualified immunity, but he does not ban chokeholds. He does not ban no knock. He calls for a registry, but the registry is not open to the public. So it mimics our bill, but it doesn't have the teeth or the enforcement.
Because there are some similarities, you know, and at least President Trump has indicated that he would sign it. Why shouldn't Democrats support Scott's bill maybe for right
now? This is the time for transformative change, not superficial change. I think it would do an incredible disservice to all of the people who've been out there for over 30 days to pass legislation that really is not going to make a huge difference.
So all of this legislating has happened amid calls to defund police in several cities across the country, including here in L.A., and I want to ask your take on that current push. Is taking money away from the police the right move right now, in your opinion?
What I think is the right move is what was done in our city of Los Angeles and in several cities around the country, where money for policing has been put back into the community. It's been refunded, as I heard on a Zoom call last week. It's been refunded supporting community services. So, you know, police in Los Angeles have to deal with homelessness, substance abuse, mental illness, and I don't think that they should have to deal with that. Until the federal government can come in and put in billions of dollars of resources, I think the local areas have to do what they need to do to make sure that the communities are supported in the best way possible.
Of course, there's a concern on the Republican side of things, on the side of people who generally support police departments, that a move like that would lead to a rise in crime. Is there anything within you that maybe thinks that this could be a possible result, though, of taking money away from
law enforcement? I think that's always said. Anytime any changes are made, the threat is always that crime is going to increase. And unfortunately, in the case of Alabama and Rayshard Brooks' death, the police officers then decided to call in sick. In New York, when the police were disciplined for knocking the man down and lying and saying that he tripped and fell, 57 officers quit. It's that kind of behavior that is most important for a culture change.
It's certainly been surprising. Well, with the time we have left, Congresswoman, I want to ask, it's been said that the Biden campaign is considering you as a potential vice presidential pick. So I wanted to ask, has the Biden camp contacted you about this?
You know, if you want to talk about the campaign, it's best that you contact them. My focus and my sole focus is on making sure that we get this over the finish line and to the president's desk.
I want to take another stab at this, maybe from a different direction. If the Biden camp asked you, would you be interested in becoming his vice president?
You know, again, I would refer you to the campaign and say that I am going to do everything possible to make sure that come January 2021, the world is relieved of what we have been through the last 4 years.
I wanted to end by kind of coming full circle in a way, because I mentioned at the beginning, you were protesting police brutality in 1973. That also happens to be the same year that George Floyd was born.
Exactly.
And so I wanted to ask, for Black boys born today, what's your vision for how they might interact with law enforcement 46 years from now?
I want to make sure that Black boys who are born today do not have to have the talk.
Well, I know that talk.
Don't we all? That's a talk for Black girls, too.
Congresswoman Karen Bass sponsored the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act of 2020. Congresswoman, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
That was Take Two's Austin Cross talking to Los Angeles Congresswoman Karen Bass. All right, talking to little kids about racism can be tricky, it can be difficult. So how about giving them a book to read that's packed with cool art and inspiring messages?
I feel like these images are so important because there are less books and content out there that show marginalized children.
Find out all about these books when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. After the death of George Floyd at the hands of police and all that has followed, parents and grandparents, just like myself, have been talking with our kids about race, protest, and police violence. These conversations are different depending on where you're coming from, but there are some messages about race and inclusion that are universal. To help facilitate those conversations for families, my next guest has written two children's books. Grace Byers is the author of the New York Times bestseller, I Am Enough and I Believe I Can, though she is probably best known for her role as Annika Calhoun in the Fox drama Empire, or as Cookie Lyon calls her, Boo Boo Kitty. Grace, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much for having me.
I watched every episode, by the way, so that's why I know that yeah. you and Cookie did not get along on Empire, but that's another topic for another conversation.
Right. Yeah. And the nickname always makes me giggle.
Yeah. Now, your books feature a variety of kids of different backgrounds with important messages about inclusion. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to write these books now?
Well, for me, myself, I am biracial and I'm also multicultural. And so in addition to both of those things, I'm also a CODA. I'm a child of deaf adults. So because of all of these differences, I was bullied a lot for, you know, just being different in many ways and forms. And I really felt, looking back in retrospect, that if I had seen more representations of me, then I feel like I would have been more encouraged. I would have felt a little less alone. So ultimately, you know, the journey of learning and embracing and celebrating my own differences was just a long one. And so with these children's books, I really wanted to see what I could do to help both little girls and boys embrace and celebrate all parts of their just unique and different and beautiful selves.
You mentioned how you were bullied because you were different. And as much as I would love to believe that bullying would someday go away, it's not. It's just, you know, human beings are going to bully human beings for the end of time. But I'm wondering, so a book like the ones you wrote, is it for the kid that's being bullied to understand that, you know, number one, they're not alone, and number two, that their uniqueness makes them special? So even though they're being bullied, they can maybe get through it a little bit better.
Yes. And can I tell you something? Mm-hmm. I fashioned it in a way for the person, the child being bullied, and also for the bully. Mm. Because I truly believe that children bully other children because they feel like they're not enough. And they feel like they have to tear down other children in order to feel special, in order to get the attention, in order to get the laughs. And so I really believe that it's sort of like a catch-22. It can become a cycle, right? So it's like a bully will bully another child. That child will either become a victim or another bully. And so it starts this cycle of saying that, you know, we're lacking self-love here. And so with words and positive affirmations like I am enough and I believe I can, if I can target both the bully and the person being bullied, then my goal and my hope is that we can create a more self-loving, self-confident, more harmonious environment.
Now, your books feature many different kids with many different backgrounds. You have children with disabilities in both of your books. I saw a girl in a wheelchair, a girl who's bald, and I believe I can. How important was it for you to have all sorts of children represented and wearing all kinds of different clothes, too? I mean, it's like you get a broad sense of the kids in the world in these two books.
Yes, my desire with both of these books was to create the imagery of a melting pot of different children so that a myriad of children could see themselves and feel represented. But also, I think what was very important for me was to put a specific spotlight on children who might end up feeling or being marginalized. So whether that's because of the color of their skin, or as you said, disabilities, or maybe health conditions, or beliefs, or just anything else otherwise, I feel like these images are so important because there are less books and content out there that show marginalized children. And I really feel like the more a child can see themselves, the more represented they feel. And I feel like the more represented you feel, the more empowered you are.
Talking to Grace Byers, author of the New York Times bestseller, I Am Enough and I Believe I Can, two children's books. I know you're getting a ton of attention on social media about both of your books. What are you hearing from parents who might be reading your books for the first time during this time with their kids?
I am so encouraged by all the parents that are reaching out. I mean, when I Am Enough dropped a few years ago, there were so many parents of color that reached out and said, thank you. You know, my child really needed to see more images that looked like them and needed words to let them know that it was a wonderful, beautiful thing that they were, you know, a certain skin color or had a certain type of hair or anything like that. And what I'm getting now more in these times are more white families and more white mothers in particular that are reaching out to me and saying, thank you. I realized that I needed to diversify my content at home and start to have conversations with my children. And these books are helping to ignite those conversations. And that really makes me happy.
Now, both of your books have very important lines that really tug at your heart. In I Believe I Can, you write, "My presence matters in this world. My life is worthy. There's a plan." Tell us about those messages. How important were they for you to include in your books?
Very important. I believe that both of these books were very divinely inspired. I have had very intimate, beautiful experiences with God, and I just really feel that we were not put on this earth just to exist. I really feel like so much of what it is that we are meant to do is to love and give and to serve each other. And I think that it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So I find that, you know, in a world where there's a lot of narrative and a lot of language that can make someone feel like there is no value and there is no worth to who they are, I put those words in there to be a reminder to say, no, you were not just born on happenstance, even if you weren't planned, even if, you know, you were unexpected, that, you know, there is a reason and there is a purpose for your life. And to just always remember that, even if you're not hearing it, you know, wherever you're going, just know that you are loved and that you are worthy just as you are.
And in addition to the worth, one of the things that also stuck out to me, especially in the text of the books, was this line. It's from I Am Enough. "I'm not meant to be like you. You're not meant to be like me. Sometimes we will get along and sometimes we will disagree." Now, it rhymes, Grace, which is awesome. But number two, it's true, right? I mean, sometimes I think in kids' books, they're a little too flowery. They're a little too kumbaya. And sometimes the reality of life has to be reflected in kids' books. And I don't think it is that often, but that line is pretty spot on, right? Because no, we're not always going to agree. I mean, this world, Grace, we don't agree on a lot of things, but kids also have to know that, you know, we're not going to disagree on everything.
Yes, absolutely. And as a child, you know, not agreeing with other children or other children not agreeing with me or me feeling different or being different, it was so emotional for me. And I think we forget that just children feel things deeply. They feel life and see things just so deeply. And so these things can really affect them. But the more that we can normalize that there are differences in life, you know, normalize that idea, I think that it will be easier for children to be able to walk around the world as they are, who they are, and to embrace that and to say, yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, we won't agree that yellow is the, you know, best color in the box, and that that's okay. That differences work. You know what I mean? And I think it's a great introduction to, as I said before, ignite these conversations, because really we're preparing them to grow up. And so if we are creating these flowery, idealistic worlds that just don't exist right now, then when reality does hit our children, that sometimes they can take it really quite hard. So I think it's just kind of starting with the foundation here that says, you know, being different is okay. Learn to expect that. Learn to embrace that. And even more, let's celebrate that.
Now, here you're also working on another book. What's this new one's going to be about?
So the first two are companion books. And I think what people will realize about me, as you said just 2 minutes ago, is I really love to rhyme. I love the musicality and of the rhymes. I do. It's a bit like poetry.
I love it, too. I love doing that as often as I can. I mean, it's fun.
Yes. And it helps you remember, you know. So this one will be a rhyming couplet book as well, but it's not going to be a book on positive affirmations. What it will be is a story. So I am following a little child throughout their day. And the premise behind it is that exactly what we were just talking about, this child desires to go out and to have what they deem to be a perfect day. So they kind of talk themselves up and they're like, I did everything right. This day is going to be perfect. And much to the child's chagrin, the day doesn't go perfectly. And so at the end of the day, the child sits with their parents and they try to kind of figure out what a perfect day really means and what we can do if our days don't go just as we planned.
Grace Byers, actor, author of the New York Times bestseller, I Am Enough, and I Believe I Can. Grace, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
All right, coming up when Take Two continues, a tribute to a Hollywood icon, legend Carl Reiner. Passed away at the age of 98. Writer, producer, director, actor, so much. We're going to get into some of his work when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
chain, my heart. Unchain my heart. Baby, let me be. Unchain my heart. 'Cause you don't care about me. You got me sort of like a pillowcase, but you let my love go to waste. So unchain my heart, oh please, please set me free.
Back down to more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. The majority of Korean Americans in Southern California are evangelical Christians, but certainly not all. As part of our series, Homeland, KPCC's Aaron Schrank has a story of a pioneering LA activist who is trying to carve out room in the Korean American community for people like her.
Juhi Judy Han is proudly queer and proudly Korean-American, two identities that didn't always mesh growing up in L.A.
Especially in Southern California, I think a typical Korean-American experience is actually growing up in a church-dominated community life.
She spent the last 20 years fighting for LGBT acceptance, both here and in South Korea. She told me about a trip a few years ago to the Korea Queer Culture Festival, Seoul's annual Pride Parade.
It's one of those spaces where you can forget for a second that there's homophobia and transphobia in your everyday life.
Han was marching with a group of Korean LGBT Christians and their supporters, known as the Rainbow Yesu Contingent. Yesu is the Korean word for Jesus. She shares video of what happened next.
But then just outside of this queer pride in the middle of Seoul, there are protesters. They're singing Christian hymns, praying very loudly, but at the same time, they're also shouting slogans. There's a group who are chanting in Korean, die, 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 to me, to us. When they start singing Jesus Loves Me as an attack against queer and trans folks, we hear this song and recognize it. We took it over. We transformed it into a song of pride. When we started singing more loudly than they did, I could see on the faces of the anti-LGBT Christians that this is not what they expected.
Han's used to challenging expectations. When she came out as gay, the only person her parents told was their Korean-American pastor at the First Wilshire United Methodist Church, where they were both deacons. Han says she decided in high school that Christianity wasn't for her.
At church one day, I asked one too many questions. Then I lost interest. What's the point if I can't ask questions? I left.
Her activism began later, in 1999, when Korean-American Christians were pushing an anti-gay bill in California.
It was radical, even by conservative standards. And they just ran with it, and it grew and grew and grew. And it kind of took over the immigrant Korean-American community.
They were advertising in Korean newspapers and gathering signatures in front of Korean grocery stores. A bunch of high-profile Korean-American pastors signed on, including Han's parents' pastor. So she and other LGBT activists formed a group called Korean Americans for Civil Rights to fight the bill with ads of their own.
To speak back to the community, to let folks know in Korean, in the Korean language press, that we will fight back.
This was the first statewide political campaign to really involve Korean-American churches, but it wouldn't be the last. The petition drive failed, but built Korean-American support for later efforts like Prop 22 and Prop 8. The campaign also inspired Han's academic career. Today, the 48-year-old cultural geographer has been researching Korean religion and politics for the better part of 20 years. She's an assistant professor in gender studies at UCLA, where I visited one of her classes.
We're a couple minutes early, but
the whole class is actually on power. But the way I teach the class is through the lens of travel. Migration, folks seeking asylum, to tourism.
Anyone personally affected by any of the travel bans or restrictions because of the virus? Yeah. Part of what I try to do when I teach anything to do with Korean religion and Korean American religion, first of all, is to dispel any assumptions they might have about what it means to be Korean.
Like the assumption that you have to be Christian starting
to be Korean or something like that.
Han says a big part of why she does what she does is to assert her presence in her community.
Like, I'm just as part of this community as anyone else. By that, I don't mean that I deserve to be here or something like that, or I've earned it. But it's just, I'm already part of this.
Han no longer identifies as Christian, but that won't stop her from challenging the power of Christian institutions in Korean communities from L.A. to Seoul. Covering religion and diaspora, I'm Aaron Schrank.
And now the end is near, and so I face.
And we close today with this. Hollywood legend Carl Reiner has died at the age of 98. His career as a writer, producer, director, and actor spanned decades, earning him 9 Emmys and left a lasting influence on comedy that's really hard to quantify. Reiner created The Dick Van Dyke Show. He directed the Steve Martin movie The Jerk, among others. He acted in Ocean's 11 and even voiced a character in Toy Story 4, a rhino called Carl Reiner Osiris. And he was also awarded the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. We were lucky enough to have him as a guest on Take Two a couple of times in recent years, and it was clear that his love of creating, performing, and making comedy was enduring.
Anytime anybody says, let's be funny, let's have fun, let's do comedy, I'm there, because comedy is what makes life so much pleasanter, easier, comfortable. I'm a big fan of comedy.
Reiner continued to write in many ways right up until the end. He even embraced Twitter, where he had nearly 400,000 followers. And we asked him what he thought the biggest misconception was of people in their 90s.
That they're finished. They're not finished. As long as you're breathing and can get angry, and then that'll show you that you're really alive.
Carl Reiner died at the age of 98. Carl, thanks for the laughs.
Way. Yes, there were times I'm sure you knew.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. If you missed any part of the show today, you really ought to find wherever you get your podcast. Take Two today was just on fire, so please look us up. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.